Okay, I was asked to talk at this session about law and LGBT issues. And as I've been teaching that for about 15 years, well, we could have had a weekend on everything and anything, and we could still be looking forward to next weekend's classes. So I really tried to think hard about what I might talk about and do it in a way in which it would be an example of what takes place throughout LGBT healthcare. Now, I've just been involved during last summer. We just did an extensive piece of research relating around transgender people's experiences of equality, inequality and discrimination. So I'm going to focus again on trans issues, but I'm very, very, very aware that a lot of what I am saying can be directly transferred onto lesbian and gay people's experiences of what takes place in healthcare. So we're going to start off. I don't know if any of you remember these words. They were from a presentation by John Reid in 2003, who became the Secretary of State for Health, and he said the National Health Service needs to be free at the point of need, truly patient-centred. Capacity and choice are not alternatives, they're partners in progress. And fairness is the cornerstone of the NHS itself, social fairness in the relief of pain and distress. And we thought, maybe. One of the most significant cases trans people had or experienced a success in was this case in 1999, which is based around here in the Northwest region, AD&G against Northwest Lancashire Area Health Authority. And I've just got some of the headlines from the newspapers at the time. It was a Court of Appeal case which held that, well, we'll go into what it held in a minute, but this is the sort of things you've got. NHS must pay for sex swaps. Transsexuals win right to sex change. Sex changes on the NHS. And only finally, when we get to the British Medical Journal, do we get something sensible which says blanket ban on treating transsexuals is ruled unlawful. What actually took place in that case was three trans women who were already living as women took Northwest Lancashire Health Authority to court over the refusal to actually fund them to have an assessment, just the assessment, to see whether they should have gender reassignment services. So these people were already living as women, but they weren't going to be allowed to see a psychiatrist to be assessed as to whether they should have further treatment to facilitate them living as women. Now, in fact, the Court of Appeal held that an English health authority had acted unlawfully in refusing to pay for sex change operations for three transsexuals on the ground that they had no overriding clinical needs. So that was the basis upon which the health authority had refused. There was no overriding clinical need. Now, of the two of the judges in the case, Lord Justice Buxton said that the authority had given no rational consideration to the question before that was deciding to give no funding at all to a procedure supported by respectable clinicians and psychiatrists which relieves extreme mental distress. So in other words, they've not actually given this automatic assumption that sex changes should not be provided by the National Health Service. That was there right from the beginning of this case, an assumption by everybody working within the system that sex changes, well, they're a bit dodgy, aren't they? And these people could choose to do something else, like get married and have children and do things like that to cure themselves. Lord Justice Auld actually went on to say that the authority's policy was flawed. It did not treat transsexualism as an illness, but as an attitude or state of mind which does not warrant medical intervention. As a consequence of the case, it was held that, in fact, there should no longer be a blanket assumption by administrators that gender reassignment services should not be provided. That was 1999. No blanket assumption should ever be made that gender reassignment treatments should not be provided by the NHS. Only 3 weeks ago, I was watching online on a podcast. It's fabulous, the web nowadays. But I was watching live from, was it Hillingdon Hounslow? Primary Care Trust meeting with transsexual people stood up there giving really cogent and coherent arguments based on sound knowledge, data, facts, the law. Within 5 minutes, Hounslow actually folded completely and said, of course we'll provide gender reassignment treatments. But the trans people actually said, but we'd just like to tell you a bit more so you don't do this again next year. And persisted in taking their arguments forward. The web is fantastic. I wasn't even in Hounslow. I was in my bedroom. All right. Richard Green, Professor Richard Green, who is the former head of the Gender Identity Clinic at Charing Cross Hospital, said in a case in 2001, severe gender dysphoria cannot be alleviated by any conventional psychiatric treatment, whether it be psychoanalytic therapy, eclectic psychiatric treatment, aversion treatment, or by any standard psychiatric drugs. In other words, psychiatrists say we can't treat it any other way than helping people to have some sort of access to gender reassignment services. Last year, we did a piece of work for the Equalities Review. This piece of work is actually now available on the Equalities Review website. And sometimes it's really nice to do something bigger and better than the States. Well, we've actually done the biggest ever survey of trans people, ever, anywhere in the world. And it was 873 respondents who were all told that it would take them 20 minutes to fill in the survey, which only had 130 questions plus sub-questions. But they gamely went on to the end, despite having been told that, and did complete it. Now, I just want to talk about that experience of inequality and discrimination. We want to look at two figures. In 2004, the median waiting time for an outpatient appointment in psychiatry was 3.72 months. So if you had a psychiatric illness or a mental illness or a possible mental illness, your GP would refer you, and under 4 months you would probably get seen. Right? To take you back to the 1977 National Health Service Act, recognises gender identity disorder to be a mental illness, according to the case in 1999. Right, our results showed that the median waiting time for an initial outpatient appointment with a consultant specialising in gender identity dysphoria, so the same thing, a referral to a psychiatrist, is 2 years. For many, it is far longer. Now, the aim of the health department is now that all initial outpatient appointments in psychiatry will be within 12 weeks. But they exclude appointments for gender identity dysphoria in those figures. So let's actually have a look at how it works on the ground. And as I say, a lot of this, I think, could be related to the way lesbian and gay people are treated. I can talk about the fact that my wife, she is now my wife, is treated in exactly and precisely the same way because she happens to have a sexual relationship with a transsexual man. Me, you know, but the very fact that she lives with me immediately means that her sexuality is called into question, which immediately means that whenever she's accessing healthcare, the question of what she does in bed and who she does it with immediately determines the length of time in which she'll wait for a dental appointment. One remark here from a person to our somebody who responded to our survey: I had to change GP because he just could not accept gender dysphoria as being real. And Christine talked about some of the figures that we'd got. Let me just highlight those figures in terms of a 1969 survey of US family doctors in the United States. This was done by Richard Green, the former head of the Gender Identity Clinic at Charing Cross. He found that over 25% of family doctors were unwilling provide any advice or treatment for trans patients. And 8 actually said they would rather their patient committed suicide than had any treatment that would enable them to live in the opposite gender. So this is our figures that Christine referred to. How GPs responded when patients sought advice on gender reassignment. And as you can see, 6% refused to help completely. Right? 13% did not appear to want to help. So whatever they did to their patient, they came into that category of appearing to refuse to help. And the patient gave them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. That's almost one in five trans people goes to their doctors and said, I would like to have some help because I'm really confused about my gender and my gender identity. And they say, nothing I can do for you. Go home, get married, have some kids, it'll secure you. 20% were informative and helpful. So there were actually 20%, one in five again, people went to their doctors and actually had a really positive experience. But in between, the 60% in between, doctors said they would help, but they had no information at all. And this goes on and on. There's a couple of statements from people going to hospital. The top one's actually from a guy who's well known locally within the region, and I'm sure he won't mind anybody who recognises him being mentioned, because he is totally out. But last time he went to hospital for a hysterectomy, he said there was a nurse explaining to her colleague as they left my room, oh, that's a woman who wants to be a man. Clearly audible both to me and by other patients and visitors. This is a guy who's lived as a man for 32 years and has a beard as big as that guy's there. Right? But they were going round the ward calling him a woman. In fact, he arrived home last night, having gone for a first stage of phalloplasty operation, all work prepared, everything covered. He went in November and it was cancelled. He arrived yesterday and it was cancelled again. And they said, we'll get in touch with you sometime later in the year. Totally ignoring the fact that he'd come down from Manchester to London, that he'd actually not had a bed at the hospital the previous night, so he'd had to go out at midnight and find a room in a hotel. This is the sorts of level of service treatment that we are sending people from Manchester to receive down the other end of the country. Is that really what we want to do? When we could do it perfectly well here on our own doorstep. We could get the very best surgeons here on our own doorstep simply by asking them to come and visit us and do the work up here. We have operating theatres that are as good as anybody else's. Percentage of respondents refused treatment by a doctor or nurse because they did not approve of gender reassignment. 68% were not refused, right? But at least 17% of people were refused some sort of treatment because a doctor or nurse said openly, I don't approve of what you're doing. I looked at that question over a period of time. I said, have things changed? Well, if you see, the green column is those people who transitioned to their new gender over 15 years ago. And the blue column is those who've transitioned within the last 3 years. Right? And these were percentage of patients who faced problems in obtaining funding for gender reassignment surgery from their primary care trust by date of transition. It's not improved to what it was in the early 1990s to what it is now. We still have almost 30% of people being refused funding for treatment and have to appeal it each time. A doctor supposed to be treating me for appendicitis exposed my genitals for a group of students to see. Referral for knee surgery, I think this is the same one. The letter was mainly about my being trans and only mentioned my knee in passing. After tests following a head injury, the doctor wrote to my GP starting with, this transsexual, which was completely irrelevant. We had the most wonderful experience. My partner had twins in the mid-90s, and I kept taking to the hospital for the many, many scans that you have when you're having twins. And I'd walk towards the scan room, and they'd look at Sarah, and they'd say, do you want him to come in? And she'd say, oh, yes. And they'd go, oh, all right, okay. So I'd go in. It was only about 4 months into the pregnancy that the notes were left at the end of the table, and of course we started to read them. And my doctor had referred to, they said, this woman is having babies by donor insemination. Her partner is a female transsexual. Now, what does a female transsexual look like to you? Certainly don't look like a guy they obviously thought was the taxi driver who took her to the hospital. Again, we did get an improvement in terms of the number of respondents who felt that whether being trans affected the way they could access non-trans related routine treatment in the NHS. It's much better nowadays. Except, of course, most of these people haven't had the same amount of life in which to try and access the NHS as much, but it's still over 1 in 10. So, truly patient-centred care. Why do trans people need access healthcare? And why do they need to access it here? Right? Well, first of all, I used to rant and rage for years about the fact that treatment was essential for trans people to get into the workplace. You couldn't keep a job in the workplace unless you were in some process of getting gender reassignment treatment. Well, I actually want to look at it slightly different. First of all, in order to obtain letters for surgical treatment, trans people have to do what's called the real life test or real life experience, at least a year living in their new gender role. Well, you can't do that successfully without accessing some hormone treatment in the first place. And that could be done very easily locally. You have to have at least an assessment and some treatment to obtain a gender recognition certificate to get your new legal rights. You have to have what's termed be under medical supervision in order to obtain your employment protection, and that will also be in the future goods and services protection. If you have not had some medical supervision at some point for being trans, you will not get employment or goods and services protection. And of course, to need to fulfil their lifelong needs. So, last two things, very quickly. The medical facts of obtaining gender reassignment, the reluctance of the family doctor to refer, the reluctance of the PCT to fund even assessment, the reluctance of the clinics to give the go-ahead. They act as what I term the coercive gatekeeper. They tell you must wear certain sorts of clothes, you must submit to certain sorts of physical examinations, you must do this and you must do that because unless you've done that, we won't give you the letter. And the reluctance of GPs to prescribe. You know, hormones are prescribed to thousands of people, millions of people up and down this country. And as soon as it comes to a transsexual person, they go, oh, I don't know anything about prescribing hormones. Never done it before. And finally, to move on, the future. I'd say these things exactly stand virtually word for word for the treatment of LGB people as well. The Equality Directive that comes into force in 2007 says there must be goods and services protection for trans people. In other words, currently, yeah, if a trans person is the best person for the job, you have to give them the job in your shop. But you can tell them that if a trans person walks through the door, you must not serve them. Well, hopefully that will be resolved. But how are we going to make that work? And the new gender equality duty that comes into force on the 1st of April. Well, all healthcare providers, every single one of them, needs staff development regularly raising trans people's issues and LGB issues. They also need, there should be no basis, such as a conscience clause, for any doctor to refuse to treat. And that includes the doctors who refuse to treat LGB people for sexually transmitted diseases or anything else. One friend of mine said he thought he had a sexually transmitted disease, and his doctor thought he didn't want to look because he didn't want to look at anything that disgusting. And that was the word he used. Education on what it is to be a trans person, on trans persons' rights, the right to dignity, decency and respect. Dignity, decency and respect, the essentials of being in hospital. Wouldn't we like to have dignity, decency and respect in hospital? The right to privacy is afforded by the Gender Recognition Act in this case. An understanding that trans people have ordinary health needs. They're not just a sex change. They also happen to be an ingrowing toenail and the broken leg in bed number 6. Well, at some point in their life. Note, we're never people. We're only ever our disease. And trans people need treating equally alongside other patients when presenting with non-trans related health problems. All of these are basically the new law, the new gender equality duty, the new Equal Treatment Directive that comes in next year. If we want to make sure we comply with those things, we must make sure that LGBT people have exactly, precisely the same access to treatment, including conditions or syndromes or disorders that only relate to them as a group, as any other patient group in a health setting. But we're nowhere near it at the moment. And I do think it's something for the PCT, seriously, to consider. It's a money saver. Thank you.